I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Steve Farber. Steve is the president of Extreme Leadership and founder of the Extreme Leadership Institute, organizations devoted to changing the world through the cultivation and development of extreme leaders in business and beyond. Steve is listed on Inc.'s ranking of the top 50 leadership and management experts in the world. He's also the author of Greater Than Yourself, The Ultimate Lesson of True Leadership, which debuted as a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller. Steve is also the author of The Radical Edge, Stoke Your Business, Amp Your Life, and Change the World. And Steve's first book is listed as one of the 100 best business books of all time. The 10th anniversary edition just came out, and that's called The Radical Leap, A Personal Lesson in Extreme Leadership. Steve, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
And I also want to shout out to Alan Carl, who was a guest on episode 69, who connected us.
Yeah, absolutely. Who's headed for China soon, by the way.
Yeah, Alan never stops.
He does not.
So I wondered if we could start off by you talking a little bit about what extreme leadership is, and why is it that you personally have been so involved in promoting the notion of extreme leadership?
Yeah, so just to give you a little context for that question, I've been in the field of leadership development, for lack of a better term, for about 25 years, and I've had the opportunity to work with just about every kind of organization you can imagine and just about every kind of industry. And what became very clear to me as I was doing this work over the years is that leadership was really the deciding factor as to a company's or an organization's competitive advantage. And I became really fascinated with, you know, the quality of leadership and what makes for good leaders and bad ones and all that. And extreme leadership is my way of trying to condense all that thinking into a fairly simple idea, which is leadership is not about your position or your title. Leadership is not about where you sit on the org chart. It's not about what you call yourself. Leadership is about your ability to influence people around you to change the world for the better. In other words, leadership is an extreme act. By its nature, it's extreme. So extreme leadership is really just my way of saying real leadership, a person who steps up to change things for the better and is willing to pay the price to do so.
Okay, so that leads to the obvious question, which is, so if I'm a leader and I'm not exercising what might be termed extreme leadership, what do I need to change, or how do I go about thinking about making some changes? What is it I need to do differently?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously a certain amount of that, David, is going to be situational, but there's a framework. And this framework comes from, you know, lots of observation and lots of research, most of it not my own, by the way, but being privy to the research of, say, for example, Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner, you know, two of my big influencers. And really, the extreme leader is a person who strives to take what I call a radical leap day in and day out. And LEAP stands for love, energy, audacity, and proof. So the extreme leader cultivates love, generates energy, inspires audacity, and provides proof every day. So if I'm a leader, if I'm a positional leader, I'm in a position of authority, and all I'm doing is essentially telling people what to do, that's not leadership. That's telling people what to do. So I need to raise my game by, first of all, bringing my heart into my work, starting to ask the really, you know, important questions like, what are we trying to do here? What are we really all about? What's our higher sense of purpose? What kind of impact do we want to have on the world of our customers? And so it starts with asking the right kind of questions and then really engaging with work in a very different sort of a way.
Do you think it makes any difference whether we're leading a single person business or an organization with thousands of employees?
Well, I think there are certainly some differences, but in terms of the qualities of extreme leadership, no. you know, a lot of the people that I work with, either through my certification programs or people that have read my books, are not only entrepreneurs but solopreneurs. They don't have anybody working for them. They're out there doing it on their own. And others are CEOs of billion-dollar companies. So the application is going to be a little bit different, obviously. If you're a publicly traded company, you have a whole different set of requirements and lots more eyes on you and everything that you do. And if you're an entrepreneur, it's a different context, right? But it's still the same kind of principles that apply. It's still being willing to ask the really significant questions and take the risks necessary in order to have a huge impact. And nowadays, entrepreneurs can have such a huge impact, whereas it wasn't even 20 years ago where that wasn't even possible like it is today.
And what do you think some of the differences are between now and 20 years ago?
Well, in terms of that, it's technology, right? It's access. Anybody now, I'm stating the obvious here, David, but sometimes it's good to do that to remind ourselves. Anybody now has immediate access to the whole planet. You could start a business online in minutes. If you have great content and a great offer and great value to provide, with some persistence, you can have access. Whereas before, you had to be big to have access. Now, small companies can go up against the big boys. It's a phenomenal thing, really. And anybody, this podcast is a great example, right? I mean, in the old days, and by the old days, I mean, 10 years ago? David, if you wanted to do this, you'd have to get a contract with a radio station, and it was terrestrial radio, and now you can do your podcast, and you have your listeners, and you have your tribe, and you have people that love what you do. All of us have that opportunity, which is a huge shift in business. Well, obviously, it's a huge shift in our society, but it's a really huge shift in the proposition of business.
Right, but the flip side is that we all have competitors from all over the world, no matter what kind of business we're in.
That's right. The flip side is there's tons and tons of noise. So your value is more important now than it's ever been, your value proposition. If you're an information provider like I am, it's the value of your content. If you're a widget provider, it's the value that your widget brings. It's the service that backs it up. All that is absolutely important, because that's what gives us the possibility of cutting through the noise. So yes, you're right. It's gotten very noisy. But again, all of us started a level playing field, really, which is a phenomenal thing. The playing field is so different now. But what's interesting about that, David, is we're talking about leadership here, right? I'm not a technology geek. I'm just saying what I see and what I work with every day, and so do all of our listeners. I mean, and the fact that we're all listening to this shows that we're using the technology today, right? But the leadership element, love, energy, audacity, and proof, they're pretty universal. They're pretty timeless. And I have to say that in the scope of my own experience, which is not literally timeless, but it applies just as strongly today, if not more strongly today, than it did 10 years ago when I first wrote the first book.
Right, because if value is so important to leadership, then love, energy, audacity, and proof are key elements to being able to demonstrate that you are providing value.
That's right. And by the way, I don't want to just throw those words out there, loosely. The word love is a provocative word in the context of business. So let me just summarize it like this really, really simply. As a business person, to have that value that we've been talking about here, you want to create something that your customer, whether it's a product or a service or combination of the two, that your customer is going to love. It's not enough to be okay. It's not enough to be satisfactory. We want our customers to love what we do for them. So love is a hardcore business principle. And if that's going to happen, if we're going to create that kind of product or service, doesn't it then follow that the people creating that product and service, in other words, your employees or yourself or your colleagues, should love what they're doing? In order to create an experience that our customers are going to love, the service providers, to create that experience in any meaningful or sustained way over time, our hearts have to be in it. And if I'm a leader, a positional leader, there's no way I'm going to create a culture that people love working in unless I love the work myself first. If I want to create a product or a service that my customers are going to love and therefore help me cut through the noise, etc., I have to love this. If my heart's not in it, the only option I have is to fake it. And people have a pretty good BS meter. They know when I'm faking it. So this gets very personal. Extreme leadership is a very personal thing. It's about starting with asking ourselves the question, why do I love this business? Why do I love it? Before I start asking my clients to.
So it starts with understanding yourself, behaving a certain way, perpetuating that behavior with those inside the company, employees, I'm guessing also with contractors and vendors, and then communicating that kind of behavior and those values to customers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it can get very at some point you have to operationalize this, right? So it has to translate into behavior and into the way that we do business. But I think for a lot of people, we jump to that a little bit too quickly. As important as it is, we want to codify a good idea. Like, so for example, this idea about love, right? So the knee-jerk reaction is to say, okay, yeah, I dig that. I mean, I want everybody to love this place. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put that on our values statement, right? I'm going to laminate that and hand it out to everybody. We love our customers. We've seen that before. It doesn't work. It's got to start with, again, that self-reflection, that self-exploration, that where I'm asking myself, what do I love about this place? Why do I love my employees? How can I make the environment around here a place that's more enjoyable for people to work in? And by teasing that out, that, as you say, it eventually translates into what does that look like around here? So if I really do love my team, what should that look like in the way that I work with them, the way I give them feedback, and the way that I reward them, and the way that I get correct behavior, and the way that we relate to each other, and the way that we communicate to each other, and the kind of emails that I send. I mean, it just has implications all the way down the line. So it becomes behavioral, but it starts with the heart, and that's the part that we have woefully overlooked for so long.
So Steve, one of the critical success factors that we talk about on this show, because it's smashing the plateau, is what you need to do differently if you've been successful, but then you have hit a plateau, you keep hitting roadblocks, and things are not going the way you hope or the way you plan. What, as a leader, what can you do differently to shake things up and to increase your rate of success? Is it possible that some of the tactics or activities that you need to use as a leader have to do with your behavior yourself and then how you behave to those inside the company?
Well, sure. I mean, there could be any number of reasons for it. And again, it depends on the scope. But, you know, plateaus are part of life. And I think it's, the important principle is to constantly be rethinking what you're doing before you hit the plateau, right? It's to minimize the plateaus. In other words, to constantly have the willingness to change things up, to try things a different way. And there are a couple of sayings that have become a bit of platitude over the years, but they're really great and they make a lot of sense. You know, the old saying that you should never rest on your laurels, right? And that's because someone once said today's laurels are tomorrow's compost. So success is oftentimes the biggest deterrent to success, because we can become complacent if things mm-hmm. are going too well, right? Marshall Goldsmith, my favorite book title of his is "What Got You Here Won't Get You There." So the idea that because something has made us successful in the past will make us successful in the future is an illusion. So we constantly have to be looking at the way we do business and be willing to change it up. And in order to do that, we have to set our sights beyond the organization, right? In other words, we need to constantly be looking at what's going on in the world around us and constantly having discussions with each other about what we're seeing and what we're noticing What are the changes, the trends that are happening, like you and I were just talking about in terms of technology, the obvious kind of mega trends, but what are the things that are happening in our industry that might have implications for our work, and what can we anticipate, what can we change now before we hit a plateau? But when that plateau, if and when that plateau does come, we have to really take a look at, we have to get beyond the emotional attachment to, well, but I want it to be the same as it always was. We have to let that go and then ask, what changes do I need to make now? And it could be a significant change. It could be a change depending on the business that I'm in, right? If I'm in the retail world, it could be a change in the channels. It could be a change in the kind of products that we sell. It could be a change in who's working here. It could be a change in our vendor relationships. But we got to, if the plateau is there, it's just a sign that says something needs to be shaken up. And we got to be willing to do that. And this is the important part. All of this comes down to experience. All of it comes down to the subjective nature of it. All the things that I've just said, nobody's going to argue with. We all know this. Any business book that you pick up will tell you that you need to shake things up, take a risk, innovate, throw things out, try again, start with a blank sheet of paper. We've called it so many things. But what we overlook is the reality in that is that it's a scary thing to do. It scares us. And that's fine. In fact, I think fear in the right context is actually a good thing. I call this the pursuit of the OSM, which is spelled capital O, capital S, exclamation mark, capital M, which stands for the oh shit moment, right?
Right.
So we need to create those. You know, if we need to shake things up, shake it up. And it's going to scare you. And when you feel that fear, when you feel that OSM, you'll know that, oh, that's natural. That's the way it's supposed to be. So on the one hand, you've got love as the impetus to move you. And on the other hand, the OSM is the experience of really changing things up, plateau or no plateau. It's always scary, and there's nothing wrong with that.
So as a leader, when you're facing those fears or you realize that those fears are starting to develop, what can you do to help yourself deal with the fears? And what can you do to help your employees deal with those fears?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, first of all, a lot of it is just awareness, right? So the next time you're trying something and trying something new, you're changing things up, and you feel that OSM coming on, you feel that fear. Now that we've had this conversation, you'll be able to look at that and say, oh, there it is. That's a natural thing. And it kind of reframes the experience. It all of a sudden, it's not quite so bad anymore. We automatically interpret fear as a sign that something is wrong, as an indicator that something is bad. And sometimes it is. But in the right context, it's actually a sign that something is right. It's a sign that I'm doing something. So it's easier to deal with when we understand what it represents, that it's a positive thing. And then the other thing is we've got to be very, and I encourage people to do this all the time, and it's a hard thing for most of us to do. We should be more public with our OSMs. We should be more public with our own fears. So if I'm a leader and I'm trying something new and I'm taking a risk with the business, most of us, our inclination is to try to hide that and appear like we're just cool and calm and we got it all figured out and we're perfect and we're invincible. And the reality is that nobody is. So instead, there's nothing wrong with being honest and saying, hey, listen, we're trying this out. I believe in it. I think it's going to work. I'm scared. You know, I'm nervous about it. I need your help. And people relate to that because that's the experience that all of us have. The other thing that we could do is look for opportunities to draw other people into their OSMs, right? Try to find people, find challenges for people that help them to stretch and grow a little bit, and then coach them through that. Yeah, you know, I know it's scary, but you know, it's that old cliche, feel the fear, but do it anyway. If it's for the right reasons and the right context, then there's just so much innovation that could be unleashed when people just come to terms with the fact that it's scary and that's okay.
Steve, is there an example that you might be willing to share that would elucidate a leader going through this recognition of fear and being public about it?
Sure. I'll give you two examples. Let me give you a day-to-day example, and not from the leadership world. If you've ever been married, just think about your wedding day, right? So your wedding day is what are you doing? You're making a commitment to another human being. You're making a huge commitment. You believe in the commitment. You believe in the other person, right? And to the point where you're vowing to each other that you're going to spend your life together. Now think back to your wedding day if you've been through one of those, and tell me there was no OSM on your wedding day. I mean, of course there was. I mean, I know it's the love of your life and all that, but you tell me that when you were saying I do, you weren't also thinking, oh shit. I mean, tell me that wasn't happening. Of course it was. I've had that experience twice, as a matter of fact. I know it's true. So that's, you know, day to day, we make commitments that we believe in, but it still scares us. Now, from a leadership perspective, I'll tell you a quick story. I worked with a guy a while back who was a middle manager in a big financial services company. And this was a guy that had put a lot of attention on, his name is Michael, he put a lot of attention on his own leadership development, and it wasn't working. The employee opinion surveys kept showing that his part of the company was last or second to last in the whole company, and he was tearing his hair out. So he pulled all of his direct reports together, and he stood up in front of them, and he said, I'm screwing up as your leader. He said, we all know it. The numbers show it. The feedback shows it. He said, so I need your help. He said, I need you to tell me what I need to do in order to improve as your leader. And he said, so I'm going to leave the room. They were at an offsite somewhere, you know. He said, I'm going to leave the room, and while I'm gone, I want you to write on flip chart paper all the things that I need to do to improve. And when I come back, we'll talk about it. Now, that's an OSM in and of itself, right? Wow. That's a terrifying thing for most of us to do. So he leaves the room. A half an hour later, he comes back, knocks on the door, and they said, we're not done yet.
Okay.
That's OSM number two, right? So then about an hour and a half later, they let him back in the room. Now, you have to imagine this from Michael's point of view. He comes walking into the room, and he looks around, and the first thing he sees is that all the walls are covered in flip chart paper. So it's like list after list. And when he told me this story, he said he had this clarity in that moment that he knew how he was going to respond would make or break this whole thing. So he took a radical approach, and he responded authentically. And what he said was, I'm overwhelmed. I had no idea there'd be so much stuff. And you can imagine how that felt. But here's what he didn't do. He didn't make excuses. He didn't try to justify it. He didn't explain it away. He just stood there and had a discussion with them so they could clarify some of these things. And you can imagine him walking out of there with rolls of flip chart paper under his arm afterwards. And here's what he told me. And this really kind of blew my mind, because he's so honest in all of this. I expected him to say, but you know what, Farber, it was tough, but it was like a catharsis, man. I mean, it was really a purifying thing, and it was really great. And but that's not what he said. He said, I was devastated. And that night and the next day were the most difficult of his entire career. Although some people did call him the next day to tell him, you know, Michael, there are some things you're doing well. But he hadn't asked for that, right?
Right.
And so what happened was, there's a couple of epilogues to this story. The next round of employee opinion surveys that came out, Michael's group was the second from the top in the entire company. He had jumps of 80 to 90% in most measures, right? And what's interesting about that is that the reason it happened was his direct reports, who had given him that feedback, were so moved by that experience that they went back and they had the same kind of conversations about themselves with their employees. And he ended up establishing a whole new standard of communication in that organization, because he was willing to do the scary thing and step into it and grow from it. And that's a very personal thing, you know, and it's, that would be an OSM for most of us. Talk about breaking through a plateau, man. I mean, he wasn't at a plateau. He was on the decline, and he just made himself vulnerable enough in the right way in order to prove to people that he really wanted to help improve the place. And he used himself as kind of the raw material for that. And it was just an amazing thing. So now, just to be clear for your listeners, I'm not saying that you should do that same thing. You can't prescribe that. If you're not ready to have that kind of conversation, you're better off not having it. Because again, if you start getting defensive and all that, it's a lost cause. But take it as an example of the willingness to do what's necessary, even though, and maybe even because, it scares you. If the only reason you can think of to not do something is because the idea scares you, then that's the reason to do it.
It's a great example. And actually, I wanted to take this a step further and tie it into something you said earlier about enabling other people to deal with their fears. If you are Michael's boss, or you're in another situation where you have a direct report who has some fears or is taking on some risk, how do you encourage that person to deal with the fears, deal with the risk, and work towards a solution and not be afraid of being blamed?
Yeah.
Because this is something that happens with great frequency in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I knew Michael's boss. Her name was Karen. And I had a conversation with her before this whole thing had happened, and she was concerned about Michael's career. She didn't know if he was going to make it or not. And as a result of what happened, and ultimately from that conversation that I just described to you, there was one point where Karen was looking for somebody to take over the branch operations for all of North America, and she went out to the field and asked people for their recommendations, and Michael was the near unanimous recommendation, and he got the job. So again, that's a huge turnaround with the support of his boss. So if I'm that boss, so to speak, if I'm the leader, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look for people who I really believe in, that I feel can go further. And I'm going to take that person on, perhaps, as a bit of a, let's call it project, for lack of a better word, and be very, very overt about it, and sit down with him or her and say, here's what I think you're capable of. So I'm going to give you this project or this challenge to work on, and it's going to be scary. But I want you to know that that's okay, and I'm here to help. And the fear is there because there's no guarantee it's going to work. You're taking a risk. And if it works, I'll applaud you. And if it fails, I'll help you learn from it. You know, asking the question, what did you learn from that? Or what did I learn from that? Or what did we learn from that when things go wrong? Is a very different question from, how could you be so stupid? What the hell is wrong with you? Or the classic, who do we blame for this? So it's establishing the relationship that proves that I'm here to support you, and that, you know, that requires trust. Now whether or not they believe me when I say that is a matter of what has happened in the past when they tried something and things went wrong. How did I respond in the past? So I might have to prove that I've had a, you know, a change of heart, and that now I'm looking at things differently. And the only way that I'm going to prove that is by having them try and having them screw it up and the way that I respond to it. So we have to look at our response to failure. We have to look at the way we respond to other people when they try things and fail. We can't, on the one hand, say we need to be more innovative around here, and on the other hand, say, you know, if you try something new, try something innovative, and it doesn't work, you're out of here, you're fired, it's a career-limiting move, whatever, then people are never going to be innovative. We can't say one thing and do another and establish any kind of credibility at all.
Also, it takes a very long time to build up trust, and you can destroy it in a nanosecond.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, especially in today's world with communication being what it is. There are no secrets.
Be so much easier if it was the other way around.
but it just doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
Steve, you've been involved in so many remarkable leadership activities in your career, including, as I mentioned earlier, being ranked by Inc. as one of the top 50 leadership and management experts in the world. What are you working on now? What's coming up?
There are a number of things. What's foremost on my mind right now is we've released the 10th anniversary edition of The Radical Leap. So this book has been around for 10 years, and you know, it's done very well. It's sold a lot of copies, but more important, it's influenced so many people in so many different arenas. From, I mean, you know, like the business world to education to I've heard from rabbis and pastors and ministers, and it just turned out to be a really universal thing. So we're using the 10th anniversary edition, which has a Leap self-assessment in it now. That's the new content. We're using that as a way to try to reach a new market, to reach people that haven't heard of the book before, that haven't been exposed to it. So that's the main thing. The way that I'm doing it, you know, from a business perspective, is I'm starting with everybody that's read the book. I'm looking for people that have read The Radical Leap in one of its manifestations. And there's a place that if anybody's listening has read that book, you can go to stevefarber.com/leapreaders, and there's a little video there for you. And what I'm trying to do is find people that have read the book and find the people that love the book and bring them together as a community and introduce them to each other and see what kind of energy we can create that way. So it's I'm in a community building mode right now, and it's in the very early stages. It's very exciting and incredibly rewarding. So that's my big project of the day.
It's a big project, but very important. Community is really critical for all of us.
Absolutely.
Steve, I wondered, you mentioned one of your influencers early on in our discussion. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about maybe one or more of the others.
Sure. Yeah, my major influencers in my professional life, and by influencers, I mean mentors as well. I mean, these are people that I know personally. I mentioned Jim Kouzes, Kouzes is how it's spelled. Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner are the co-authors of a book called The Leadership Challenge, which I'd highly recommend to everybody. Jim was the president of the company that I used to work for, and I was the vice president, and his work deeply influences my own. Now, the company I used to work for brings me to my second influencer, which is Tom Peters. Many of your listeners will know Tom from, he's probably the greatest management guru, you know, next to Peter Drucker that we've ever had. He's the co-author of In Search of Excellence. That was his original claim to fame. So I was the vice president of the Tom Peters company. That was the company that I worked with Jim, where I worked with Jim. So Tom Peters, in his audacity, you know, his audacious approach to things, his willingness to things, his willingness to really shake things up, had a big influence on me. And Jim and his work with the Leadership Challenge, his research and my helping people to apply his research really deeply informed my own work. And I consider myself to be one of his evangelists, as it were.
Well, those are great examples. Thank you. And lastly, I wondered if you could mention someone you know personally who is currently doing really remarkable work.
Yeah. There's a couple of people that I've gotten to know recently, and by that I mean within the last couple of years, and we're starting to collaborate on a few things, and their work is really kind of shaking things up for me in a great way. Neville Bill Moria and Alan Daly. And Alan is the chair of the Education Studies Department at University of California, San Diego. He's a professor. He's a, you know, an academic, so to speak. He's a scientist, and he's doing incredible work in social network mapping. He's really at the forefront. It's a very interesting field of study, one that I'm learning about. So he's really, you know, he's looking at the actual dynamics in cultures, in organizational cultures in particular. So you look, on the one hand, you see the org chart. The org chart doesn't really tell you what's going on in the organization. It's the network of the various relationships in the organization. And he has a methodology that he uses for taking a picture, actually looking at the maps, the network maps within an organization. And it's gotten me to think about the implications for changing culture. So Alan Daly's work is really quite phenomenal.
Fascinating. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. Steve, can you tell listeners how they can learn more about you?
Yes, absolutely. SteveFarber.com is where I live online. ExtremeLeadership.com, if that's easier for you to remember, that'll take you to the same place. If you go there, I have there's a free audio program that I've gotten great feedback on that you're welcome to sign up for. And that's where my blog lives and all the information about the books and my point of view on leadership. So it's a great place for us to connect.
Great. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Steve Farber, president of Extreme Leadership and founder of the Extreme Leadership Institute. Thank you again, Steve, for joining us.
My pleasure, David. Thank you.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.